It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
We find the defendant guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Guilty of involuntary manslaughter.
Jennifer Crumbly found guilty of 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter, one for each of the students her teenage son murdered in a shooting rampage at Oxford High School in Michigan in 2021. A historic verdict. The first parent in the country ever directly held criminally responsible for a school shooting carried out by her son. Prosecutors argued Crumbly was responsible for those deaths because she and her husband ignored her son Ethan's mental health struggles and bought him the handgun used in the shootings, even disregarding school counselors' concerns about Ethan's behavior just hours before the attack.
She walked out of that school when just the smallest of things could have saved, could have helped Hannah and Tate and Madison and Justin.
Crumbly took the stand in her own defense and testified that she didn't see herself as a failure as a parent.
I trusted him, and I felt like I had an open door and he can come to me about anything. I mean, I felt as a family, we were the three of us were really close. Of course, I look back after this all happened, and I've asked myself if I would have done anything differently, and I wouldn't have.
That remark was repeated during the jury's deliberations, and after 11 hours, the jury found Crumbly guilty of involuntary manslaughter 4 times for the 4 deaths. Craig Schilling, whose 17-year-old son Justin was killed in the shooting, said Crumbly would not be sitting in prison if she had done her job as a parent.
It is your choice to have a child, and you cannot choose to not take care of your child. You cannot choose to not nurture your child. You cannot choose to take your own interest over your child, especially when it comes to mental health.
Ethan's father, James Crumbly, will also be tried for involuntary manslaughter at a separate trial this month. And Ethan was sentenced to life in prison in December after he pleaded guilty to murder, terrorism, and other crimes. Joining me is Frank Vandervoort, a professor at the University of Michigan Law School.
So the first big question is, were you surprised when the jury came back with the 4 guilty verdicts?
I would say that I was mildly surprised. This was a difficult case for the prosecution to make because their burden was to show beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a direct linkage between Ms. Crumbly's actions or her failures to act and the shooting without having an intervening occurrence or factor. And in this case, I thought it would be a very difficult case for the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that standard because of the intervention of a 15-year-old whom the state itself tried as an adult and said he was fully responsible for these acts. And so I am somewhat surprised that the verdict came back the way that it did.
Tell me how the prosecution built its case, the most important pieces of it.
Well, what they did is they took the text messages, you know, the journal entries in the boys, you know, handwritten journal, and combined that with the fact that a short time before this, you know, they purchased the gun only days before this incident. And so I think the prosecutor painted the mother as being someone who was just out of touch with what was happening with her son that he was in this sort of downward mental spiral and that she should have been aware of that. And despite that, the parents went out and purchased this handgun, which they then stored in a negligent fashion so that he could get access to it, you know, sort of unrestricted. And so I think it's that unique set of circumstances that the prosecution built the case on and focused on.
Yes, and one of the things that prosecutor Mark Keast focused on during an hour-long cross-examination of Crumbly were some texts from her son just months before the shooting, where he said he was seeing demons throwing bowls and asking her to text him back. Let's listen to that.
When your son texted you that he was seeing demons and bowls flying off the shelves, that was in the spring of 2020, when you recall that evidence, right?
Correct.
You don't dispute that that was on your phone?
No.
You don't dispute that at some point you read those messages?
No.
I believe it was at his sentencing that Ethan said that his parents were not responsible for what he did, and the defense wanted to call him to the stand, but they weren't allowed to.
Yes. So he didn't testify because he still has a Fifth Amendment right. His case will certainly go on appeal. Even though he pled guilty, there's going to be an appeal in which they make arguments that certain of the evidence, perhaps even that some of the charges should not have been brought or were barred. And so that's why he didn't testify.
For the defense, was the brunt of its case Jennifer Crumbly's testimony?
My impression was is that she was trying to show that there were many areas where the prosecution hadn't met its burden, that there were a number of reasons that the jurors might have said not guilty in this case. And so, you know, that was a strategy that they picked. You know, one can second guess that strategy, but their approach was to say there are lots of reasons here, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that you could find that she's not guilty and you should find that. So that I think was their approach.
When a defendant takes the stand, that often becomes the focus for the jury, her credibility.
And here's what the jury foreperson said about Crumbly's testimony on the Today Show this morning.
At the time, I tried to take her as she gave herself. But once we went into deliberation, it became clear that she wasn't a super reliable witness in this case.
I think in this case, the mother had to testify. I think that, you know, from a practical standpoint, you know, the jury needed to hear from her. You know, she didn't come off as the most sympathetic person, apparently. But again, you know, what should take place in a trial and what the court will instruct the jury is to, you know, you've got to set aside your emotions. You've got to set aside that sort of thinking and really focus on the facts of the case and focus on the evidence that was presented. So it is what it is. They look at her, they judge her credibility, they, you know, decide whether they think she's genuine and telling the truth or if she's in some way trying to mislead, and then they make their decision.
So one thing she said that struck me, I don't think I'm a failure as a parent, and she wouldn't have done anything differently. And apparently that last statement was something that the jurors kept coming back to as they deliberated.
Yeah, right. And if a person's in that circumstance, you know, how do you not second guess yourself, right? How do you not go back and say, you know, what would I have done differently? Would I have pulled the trigger lock out of that plastic bag or whatever, you know, packaging and put it on the gun? Would I have taken steps to secure that gun in a way that my son couldn't get a hold of it? I think anybody would do that, right? So, you know, that's the risk you take when you testify on your own behalf. On the one hand, the jury's got to hear from her, I think. On the other hand, it's a huge risk, and you can say something that either, you know, just may not be well presented, or it may be presented in a way that makes you look cold and uncaring. For a person who has been through what she's been through to not say, yeah, I really did make mistakes. There are things that I could have and should have done, and if I had it all to do over again, I would do differently. We would hope for that sort of insight, right?
A lot focused on the foreseeability of Ethan's actions. And her attorney said, how could anybody imagine that something like this would happen, that their son would do something like this? But the jury had to find that it was foreseeable in order to come to its verdict?
So the jury had to find beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a direct line from the mother's
either actions or omissions, right, or inaction, a direct line from that to the shooting. There was a lot of focus on foreseeability, but when the Court of Appeals, the Michigan Court of Appeals, decided the earlier version of this case, when it went up before the trial to the appellate court, they talked a lot about what lawyers call proximate cause. And so the fact that you have a 15-year-old that intervenes in this, that breaks that direct line from her act or omission to the shootings, I was surprised that was not more of a focus, and there was so much focus on the sort of foreseeability rather than, you know, this direct connection. And the judge instructed, she talked about that in her instruction. They have to show directly that there's this linkage. And I anticipated there would be more focus on that by the defense. I expected to see more focus on Ethan as an independent actor. And, you know, one wonders whether that may have changed the outcome.
Though the jury foreperson did say that she was swayed by the fact that Jennifer Crumbly was the last person to handle the gun that was then used by Ethan in the shooting.
And I think the responsibility of securing the weapon then falls on her.
So perhaps they saw it as Crumbly being the one that could break the chain of events, but she failed to do that.
So it's certainly one element of it, right? You had the last opportunity to prevent this. But if I were the defense lawyer, I would say, fair enough. But still, you have a 15-year-old boy who, certainly without the affirmative permission of his parent, took that gun out of the house, hid it in the backpack, took it to school, hid it from school officials, then went into the bathroom, changed clothing, you know, put a mask on and that sort of stuff, put his hood up, and then walked through the hallway shooting people. I expected to see the defense really focus much more on his action and say, yeah, even if it's true that she failed to secure the gun, this is an independent intervening factor that breaks that causal connection between what she did or didn't do in the murders.
Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, we'll talk about what Crumbly is facing at sentencing and her husband's upcoming trial on the same charges. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Can every parent really be responsible for everything their children do? Especially when it's not foreseeable? And this clearly was not foreseeable to Mrs. Crumbly.
Jennifer Crumbly's attorney, Shannon Smith, told jurors that convicting her client would set a dangerous precedent for parents and that no one could have foreseen the school shooting. But prosecutors argued that Crumbly was responsible for her teenage son's shooting rampage at Oxford High School in 2021 that left four fellow students dead. Prosecutors said she and her husband had ignored her son Ethan's mental health struggles, bought him the handgun used in the shootings, and failed to secure it. And prosecutor Mark Keast cross-examined Crumley about her son's troubling texts and journal entries.
You don't deny that your son wrote in his journal that he asked his parents for help. You don't deny that evidence that was admitted.
No, I don't.
After 11 hours of deliberations, the jury found Jennifer Crumbly guilty of 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. I've been talking to Professor Frank Vandervoort of the University of Michigan Law School. So Crumbly and the defense tried to point in other directions, especially at the father, basically saying, it's not my fault, it's really his fault.
Yeah.
He bought the gun, he didn't secure the gun.
Obviously, that didn't work.
You know, it may have worked, been a better approach, I think, had they been tried together. But by separating the trial, it just looks like she's trying to deny any responsibility rather than say, as a matter of law, forget the facts. As a matter of law, you've got an intervening factor here that really broke that causal link between her failure to secure the gun and, you know, the child taking it to school that day and shooting his classmate. It just strikes me as a line of defense that maybe could have been rethought.
So then you think she has several issues on appeal to raise?
I think so. I anticipate there's going to be an appeal, and I think there will be some issues raised that are going to be, you know, significant issues.
Now, the husband's trial, as we mentioned, his trial is coming up. Do you think that in light of this verdict, he may try to, you know, go for a plea deal?
That's always a possibility for sure. They may be looking to try to resolve the case, you know, short of a finding of 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. You know, maybe they'll ask for one or something. Interesting question whether the prosecutor would, you know, the prosecutor's probably feeling confident now that they can get another conviction on all four and may not offer that as an opportunity.
Especially since he is the one who actually purchased the gun.
Right. So, you know, there are some factors for him that are at least as troublesome as things that the mother did or didn't do. He did purchase the gun. I mean, he knew the gun was there. And, you know, I think a couple of the things in his favor are that she had the kind of almost callous, certainly unthinking response when the school contacted the parents about him looking at the bullets, I think it was on the internet, and she said, you know, haha or whatever, just don't get caught. In hindsight, that seems incredibly callous, right? You know, in the moment, maybe not so much. So I think there are some things that she had, you know, working against her that maybe the father doesn't have working against him. They will no doubt say, you know, mother's already been convicted and she was the last one with her hands on that gun. She was the last adult who had the opportunity to prevent this, and she didn't do it.
Legal experts are talking about this case as a precedent. Do you see this as providing sort of a template for prosecutors to go after other parents if their children are connected to criminal acts like shootings?
You know, I don't anticipate this is going to have a lot of influence on prosecutors' decisions. I think the facts of this case are so, you know, sort of out of the ordinary, are so unusual. I just don't think you're going to see a flood of cases like this. As a legal matter, parents have always been held civilly liable for some aspects of their children's behavior, you know, for many, many years. And criminally, there have always been some responsibility on the part of parents in relation to their children. What's unusual about this case is the severity of the charges. One area you see this sometimes is school truancy. We went through a period of time a few years ago where a number of parents around the country were charged because their older children were not getting to school or their younger children were not getting to school, right? So parents were charged criminally with not getting their kids to school. That was a thing for a while. So what's unusual about this is not so much the legal doctrine as it is, you know, just the severity of the charges. But again, the unique set of facts in this circumstance, I think, is not going to open the floodgates for these kinds of more serious charges. I think culturally it may have more impact than, you know, as a legal precedent, because I think a lot of parents are going to look at this and say, yeah, you know, make sure that the guns are secured. Make sure that we know what's happening with our children, our teenagers. And, you know, that gets harder and harder for parents. You know, the internet and the dark web and violent video games and all of the rest of it. You know, adolescents have always had secrets from their parents, right? They've always had these kind of separate lives from their parents. And part of what's happened in our culture is that some of that separate life has gotten more serious, more dangerous, potentially. And so I think the message to parents is, you know, you've got to really redouble your efforts to know what's going on with your children, be aware of what's happening in their lives, and to take precautions to make sure that they don't get access to guns and that sort of thing.
Some legal experts say that they worry that the case will be a way for prosecutors to force plea deals from parents, and that might cause more racial disparities in the criminal justice system.
Again, I don't see that happening so much. I don't anticipate that there are going to be a lot of these cases filed. My guess is that only if you have the rarest of circumstances where, you know, in this case, sort of the planets aligned, if you will, right? The kid was having serious emotional problems. The parents didn't recognize that, didn't respond to that. But, you know, there's the salacious aspect of this where she was involved in an affair. That was talked about in this trial. So, you know, the prosecutor could really paint a picture of a parent who's disengaged, who's not aware of what's going on, and then purchases a gun, takes his kid to the shooting range, and then doesn't adequately secure that gun and protect the public from what might become of that gun. One of the things that's interesting to me about this is Michigan, in the wake of this case, has now passed a law that you know, you have to have safe storage of weapons, which a number of states have. So I'm not sure today, if this were to happen again in Michigan, you'd see this level of severity of charge. You might see something much more like, you know, a failure to properly store a gun charge. That I could see happening, right? We've seen that in Michigan before. We go back 20 years. You may recall in Flint, Michigan, about 20 years ago, there was a parent who had a handgun in a shoebox underneath a bed. And a kid got hold of that gun, a six-year-old, and took it to school and shot a classmate in Flint. You know, so it's not unprecedented that a parent would be charged, you know, in similar kinds of circumstances. In that case, it was child neglect, I believe, were the charges that were brought, which had lesser penalties than involuntary manslaughter charges. So I could see prosecutors charging those kinds of crimes, right? And that has happened, I think, a time or two. You know, we saw that in Virginia recently. I think it was Virginia where the little kid took the gun to school and shot the teacher. And you saw in Illinois, there was a case, the 4th of July shooting down there, where a parent was charged because they assisted their child in getting a gun. But again, not charged with homicide-related offenses, but lesser offenses. I could see that happening.
How much of this verdict was about the prosecution doing a better job than the defense, having better theories and strategies than the defense, you know, with all the resources that the prosecution has?
I mean, certainly, you know, it's almost always the case that the state has many more resources than the defendant in any criminal case. I mean, that's almost universally the situation, right? The rarity is where there's a level playing field in that regard, right? I mean, you know, you think about O.J. Simpson, you think about, you know, Michael Jackson, you think about Donald Trump, right? They have a sort of level playing field because they have access to enormous amounts of money and resources. But in the average case, I mean, there's no difference. I don't know what speaks to that beyond, I think, the school officials. There is certainly perhaps some failures on the part of the school officials, right? And there's some frustration that governmental immunity protects the school system and some of those officials. And, you know, so I think there is some, in the community, there is some frustration about that, that the school's not being held fully responsible. You know, in situations like this, it's not at all unusual for, you know, just as the parents in this case might do, and as she tried to do on the witness stand, point the finger in the other, you know, in another direction to say, you know, it's not really my fault, it's someone else's fault. Or at least we share the blame to reduce the culpability. So I'm not surprised by that.
Can the parents of the four teenagers go after the school civilly?
There are
governmental immunity issues that have to be overcome. So there, you know, it really ratchets up the level of evidence that's necessary for the to hold the school financially responsible and civilly liable.
She faces, it's 11 years on each count. Do you think the judge will run those concurrently?
Well, I think the statutory maximum is 15 years for this case. And I anticipate, yes, that they would run concurrently. I don't know of anything in this case that suggests that they should be consecutive sentences.
Jennifer Crumbly will be sentenced on April 9th. Her husband will go on trial this month. Thanks so much for joining me on the show. That's Professor Frank Vandervoort of the University of Michigan Law School. A note, Michael Bloomberg, the founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg Radio, is a donor to groups that support gun control, including Every Town for Gun Safety. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, the stage is set for Dartmouth basketball players to unionize and become the first ever labor union for NCAA athletes. This is Bloomberg.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
The stage is set for Dartmouth basketball players to unionize, although it's a long road ahead, perhaps years, before they become the first ever labor union for NCAA athletes. On Monday, a National Labor Relations Board regional official ruled that the basketball players are employees of the school, clearing the way for an election. All 15 members of the Dartmouth men's basketball team signed a petition in September asking to join Local 560 of the Service Employees International Union. Dartmouth says it will appeal the NLRB's decision. Joining me is Albert Soler, a partner at Skorinsky Hollenbeck. How would unionizing change the lives of the Dartmouth basketball players?
So, you know, it's an interesting concept, and this is a fight that's been going on for many, many years. And so what happens is that if you unionize and the student athletes are deemed to be employees, then what happens is that they could collectively bargain and negotiate different things. For example, the compensation of any, the treatment by the coaches, the travel schedule, how many hours they can practice. That's, of course, if they're deemed employees, like any other employees who unionize, they'll have the power and they'll have the ability to actually negotiate better terms for how they conduct the, quote, work, in this case, the participation in the athletics. So they'll have more control over their daily participation in life.
These players are not being paid, are they? I mean, they're not getting any kind of compensation from Dartmouth at this point.
Yeah, so this goes back. Let me give a little bit of background on that because it's a really good and important question. So the idea of amateurism, the idea of the NCAA and the amateur athlete was really a made-up concept. It was a definition that was really created when the NCAA was founded to really hold student athletes to a non-employee status so that schools then wouldn't have to pay compensation. As a normal employee would get paid, you go to work, you get your paycheck. Here, what they were trying to do is NCAA wanted to control over what they called student athletes under a concept of amateurism, which was really a made-up term. So traditionally, throughout history, student athletes have not been paid money for their services, but the idea here was that the universities and the educational institutions were providing an education. Now, for the schools that offer scholarships, athletic scholarships, then the compensation really is the fact that you are receiving a quote-free education in exchange for your participation in sports. Now, the Ivy League schools, including Dartmouth, actually don't offer athletic scholarships. So the reality is that the student athletes at the Ivy League schools are receiving nothing more than the right to just participate in the sport. Obviously, we can't minimize the educational aspect. It's very important. These schools are, a lot of them are great. They're very renowned institutions. And I think that the student athletes receive a great education. However, the problem is that there are many schools that derive enormous amount of revenue and money and notoriety, millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars a year from their athletic programs. And so the problem there is that they are benefiting really off the backs of the student athletes who many times, to your question, don't get paid anything. And there have been, you know, important documentaries highlighting the fact that a lot of these athletes many times don't even have the money to live their lives day to day or week to week. And it reminds me of a couple of documentaries I saw where some football players from prominent schools had to ask their coach for money for food. So it raises a very interesting question. But the short answer to your question is that no, they're not being paid to, quote, play the sport. But for the schools that offer the athletic scholarships, the idea is that you're receiving the education in exchange for participation.
But Dartmouth is not one of those schools. And Dartmouth even said during this four-day hearing that the men's basketball program loses money. So if the men's basketball players are considered employees, then because of the education they're getting, then what about the students who play in the school band or other organizations? Are they employees too?
That's a great point, June. That's exactly what the slippery slope here is. I personally don't believe that they're employees. That's my personal view. Because if that's the case, and in the case of the Dartmouth basketball team, you had the school noting that they lose money. Well, if that's the case, then if they're deemed employees, I don't know what business would exist that loses money. So the result of that is going to be that Dartmouth ends the basketball program, which they may not care about doing because, frankly, the Ivy League schools are not sports powerhouses. It's not like saying in Ohio State or USC where they derive hundreds of millions of dollars from the football, from the basketball team. And so it's a very unique situation. I think making all student athletes or deeming them employees, I think is dangerous because, as you noted, each sport is different and each school is different. So there are many student athletes that will go, for example, to an Ohio State to play football because Ohio State, USC, the UCLAs of the world, they are football powerhouses, for example. So a lot of the student athletes actually go, not necessarily for the education, although it's a benefit, of course, but they do want to go to the pros. They do want to make it to the NFL. So if you think about it, your point is spot on. What this creates is a huge issue for a slippery slope of where do we draw the line. One of the articles I read makes a very important point. For example, if I am a student athlete at Dartmouth or any other university, and not student athlete, but I'm in the music program. Well, the music program will have concerts. Those concerts might be paid. So patrons might pay a ticket to go hear me play. Well, if I'm a student and I'm in the music program and the school's making money off of it, do I unionize? Do I have to then be myself an employee? Do I have to get paid? So I think it's a slippery slope because it is important to remember that universities are primarily educational institutions. And the sports traditionally were a form of marketing to allow the schools to earn more prestige. And obviously the programs that win in sports are national headlines and the brand of the school increases tremendously. But I don't know necessarily that that makes any of the student athletes employees. And some of the articles I read actually use the word, well, here they're participating in sport or compensation. And I'm not sure what they meant by compensation unless they're referring to the schools that do offer athletic scholarships. because as far as I'm aware or concerned, student athletes are not being paid to play the sport. So I'm not sure where they get that notion from, but your point is well taken and it's correct. I mean, does that mean that the music students get paid? Does that mean that the swim students get paid? June, many of these programs don't earn any money. And even at the more athletically recognized schools, you know, the Ohio States, again, schools like that, maybe the swim program doesn't generate any money. Whatever other teams that aren't football, that aren't baseball, that aren't basketball, maybe they generate nothing.
Here's what the NLRB regional director, Laura Sachs, wrote. Quote, because Dartmouth has the right to control the work performed by the Dartmouth men's basketball team, and the players perform that work in exchange for compensation, I find that the petition for basketball players are employees within the meaning of the National Labor Relations Act. And I know that the players say what matters is not whether the sport turned a profit or whether the team turned a profit. What matters is if the program brings in revenue and also whether coaches have control over the players. I find this problematic as well because you could say the professors have control over their students.
Exactly the point I was going to make. So I don't agree with that. First of all, her quote's a little bit bizarre because, as I noted, I'm not aware of the student athletes receiving compensation. Unless you're talking about the name, image, and likeness part, which I'll touch on in a second. But the idea here is I don't agree because I don't understand what compensation they're receiving. And also, the athletes don't have to play the sport. They're not being required to participate in the football program, for example, or the basketball program. They are enrolled as students. So, for example, if the teacher and the instructor or professor says to you, the student, you have to show up to my class 3 days a week, and you have a midterm on this date, and you have to go to office hours on this date. Well, they are technically controlling the curriculum, and they are controlling the manner in which the students need to fulfill their academic obligations. Does that make the students employees? I don't believe so. I don't think it does at all. And again, with respect to students and or the student athletes, they're not receiving compensation. So I'm not sure where the labor board gets that idea. Do I think that they should have be treated fairly? Absolutely. I think everybody, student athletes, should be treated fairly at a university. I'm just not seeing where the compensation comes in. And to your point, a very slippery slope, because the teachers and professors are technically controlling the conduct of the students. So are they employees? I don't believe they are.
Is this the first Ivy League school where this has happened, or is it
the first school period?
There was another, I believe, Ivy League school that did this before, but the proceedings were actually paused. And then this is the first one that I'm aware of where they actually had a ruling, and now they're going to go back and continue the other proceedings. But again, remember that this is for private institutions, which raises the whole other issue of how does a public university deal with this. But I think that the general challenge to the NCAA and this idea of amateurism and whether they're employees and whether they can receive compensation and unionize, this has been going on for a long, long time. However, this Dartmouth case is the first time where you had a regional labor board actually come down and rule and make a decision. And I think it'll be appealed because it's too significant. It's a monumental type of decision that I don't think was well thought out because of all the issues that you and I have touched on, where it opens up a floodgate of different issues. Not every school is situated the same. Not every student athlete wants the same thing. Not every student athlete is out for the same goal. Some want an education. But I do want to just touch on one thing that I think is relevant here, is that I want to make sure that folks don't confuse this issue with the name, image, and likeness issue, because they are related. If you remember back in the day, the universities, and this changed recently, and now the student athletes have an ability to actually benefit and profit from their name and image. But back in the day, you would have football players and basketball players appearing on video games, sponsorships. The school would show their image and be paid a lot of money by national brands by advertising and content. So there, it's a totally separate topic, but it is tangentially related in that no one has a right to exploit somebody's name, image, likeness, and their skills to their own benefit without compensating the students. So the idea that you can unionize and be found to be an employee, I think does go hand in hand with this attempt to rectify this problem where I'm a student athlete. I'm very, very highly regarded, The whole nation knows my football skills, and they have my name, my image, my likeness everywhere, and I don't profit from that. But the schools sure do. I mean, you can imagine the amount of money these prominent athletic programs have. They need to share that. They need to give stipends to the students. They need to make sure that the student athletes can actually be going day to day, pay for their food, pay for their housing. Again, not all schools offer athletic scholarships. So for the ones that don't, to kind of take their name, image, and likeness, not compensate them, and also not even give them a stipend, I think that's where the notion of unfair treatment arises, which then leads to these ideas of unionizing. I think if schools did the right thing and treated people fairly, I'm not saying all of them, but the ones that are taking a little bit of advantage from the student athletes, I think this wouldn't be that much of an issue.
A lot more of these legal battles ahead. Thanks so much, Albert. That's Albert Soler, a partner at Scorinci Hollenbeck. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.